Okay, everyone. Hey, can you hear me also in the back? Wonderful. Thank you so much for coming to this seminar arranged by the expert group of eight studies. I'm really glad to welcome you today, in which we launched the report Marginalized and Poor, Does Targeted Anti-Discrimination Measures Work? My name is Julia Schalk, and I'm a member of the expert group for eight studies, which I will introduce in a bit. I've also been part of the international reference group for this particular report. I'd also like to acknowledge and thank Prudence Woodford Berger, who was part of the Swedish reference group and support me with intelligent comments in that work. I'm here today to moderate this seminar. But before we start, I'd just like to say a few words about the expert group for eight studies. I think many of you by now know us, and I recognize many faces from previous seminars. But for those of you who don't, we're a government committee responsible for evaluating and analyzing Swedish international development cooperation. We produce studies and organize seminars like this, but also other types of seminars, on themes and issues that we think are important to development cooperation, and obviously with the overall purpose of actually contributing to its improvement. The work that we do is characterized by what we call a dual independence. That means that the expert group itself is independent, and we decide what studies to commission and to publish, but the author, in that sense, are also independent towards the expert group itself. EBA, in short, presents our conclusions and recommendations, however, in one annual EBA aid review, which is, as in every year, going to be presented in March this year. And our ambition is to build bridges between policymakers and researchers and practitioners, all of you who are gathered here today. And we hope that our seminars are a meeting point from these groups, and which we hope, and the seminars we think are equally almost important as the reports, because that's where the conversation actually takes place, and we do bring a lot of the recommendations also from the seminars itself. Today, we have the pleasure of launching a report focusing on the intervention and measures that aims to reach the poorest and most marginalized people. It's titled, Do Anti-Discrimination Measures Reduce Poverty Among Marginalized Groups? It's written by Rachel Marcus, Anna MD, Ella Page at the Chronic Poverty Advisory Network, CPAN, linked to ODI in UK. We're going to use these 2 hours by first, obviously, I will talk a bit further, and then we will have the report presented by the authors. Rachel Marcus and Andrew Shepherd will also introduce the project at large a bit more. And then we will receive comments and reflections from Per Zetterberg from Uppsala University, Paula Engvall from SIDA, and Wilson de Rosreyes Aragon from RFSU. And this will be followed by panel discussion, and we look forward also for your comments and questions, of course. Before I ask Rachel and Andrew to join me at this stage, I'd just like to say a few words on why we commissioned this report. The objective for Swedish Development Cooperation, I'm sure you know, is to create opportunities for people living in poverty and under oppression to improve their living conditions. And with the assumption that discrimination is a reason for keeping people in poverty, we wanted to look at what measure would work to support them to not be poor. And discrimination in itself is clearly a part also where the linkages, I think, between oppression and poverty also comes in place. And discrimination is clearly very much the reality of people living in poverty and their experiences that they feel and meet. A very personal illustration of this or a meeting that I had was with the people living that I met in Lusaka, people living and working within the lesbian and gay community, and they share their very personal anxiety of not being able to go to the health service facilities available because of fear of being discriminated and judged in that setting. Happily, though, there was one facility where they felt there was a safe space to receive STI and HIV testing, but also counseling. And that's just one small but illustrative example of how discrimination and poverty and access to services are interlinked. It's also clearly visible in the Agenda 2030. The whole framework is actually built on the foundation and notion that no one should be left behind. In practice, that means that the people living in poverty, the poorest and the discriminated people, must be given access to power, human rights, justice, services such as education and health in order to fulfill their human rights, but also be included in economy, in politics, and in society at large. Also visible throughout the targets of the Sustainable Development Goals, we see, for example, on gender equality, it's referred to discrimination in Goal 10 to reduce inequality within and among countries. Goal 6 is a little bit like poetry, I have to say. I have to read it. Promote peaceful and inclusive societies for sustainable development, provide access to justice for all, and build effective, accountable, and inclusive institutions at all levels for all. It's nice, isn't it? It's also visible in Goal 17, which is linked to trade. And the demand for indicators that are disaggregated beyond global and national levels is obviously also a recognition of the fact that we need to move beyond global and national indicators and see how different groups are affected by the interventions made for development. So, but the question is then, if there is a link between discrimination and poverty, can we reach sustainable development through anti-discrimination measures? And what works best? For whom? And are we actually reaching, with that perspective, the poorest of the groups that we are targeting? In order to know better, we wanted to look a little bit more sort of on existing material, but also to get a little bit of a sense on how Sweden, and CEDA in particular, is already working on this. We decided, because we were already doing NERAS on behalf of EBA, we're doing a country portfolio analysis on Swedish bilateral aid to Palestine and Mozambique. So just to get a sort of sense if this is something that's already recognized, they found in these two countries that 25% of the contributions that were provided in these countries reach were actually targeting discrimination for marginalized groups. Most of the funding was provided to social services or promotion of human rights. Their conclusion was that most of the interventions were actually with the aim of empowering rights holders and their organizations, and not as much as focusing on the duty bearers' formal actions against discrimination, which I think could be an interesting discussion afterwards when we hear the conclusions of the report. So then we had a conversation with the CPAN, and we thought their ambition to provide an overview of the existing knowledge base was a great idea to start with. And therefore, sorry, I've lost a little bit of track. So therefore, we were really glad that we could support this, the commission of the report, Do Anti-Discrimination Measures Reduce Poverty Among Marginalized Groups? And with that, I'll stop talking, and I'd like to welcome the authors of the report, who you actually come to listen to, up on the stage. Please, Rachel and Andrew, could I invite the two of you up here? And while you do that, I'll introduce the two of you. Andrew Shepherd is the director of CPAN, previously director of the Chronic Poverty Research Center. He has worked on several large evaluations and anti-poverty policies and programs. He's been director of programs at ODI and previously a staff member of UNICEF in Sudan, as well as a renowned lecturer and senior lecturer at Birmingham University. I'm sure. And you will present a little bit more of the project at large. Yeah. And then Rachel Marcus, who is a social development researcher and research associate at the Overseas Development Institute. Her work is very much focused on gender equality, children's and young people's development, social inclusion more broadly. In recent years, she's led an evidence review on gender and youth livelihoods development, gender equality in education. I see that we have quite a lot of education sector representatives here. Communication strategies to promote gender equality, youth civic and political participation on effective integration of anti-poverty and child protection programs. And she has also worked on social aspects of climate change, which are good interlink. So with that, we are very much interesting to learn about the results and the forthcoming discussions in which we will also, of course, invite the audience. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm going to be brief because Rachel is going to give the meat of the report, and we should get to that, I think, as soon as we can. But I just wanted to say a few words about the Chronic Poverty Network and what we do. So the reason that we exist, we were originally a research center, but at the end of the research center, our colleagues in developing countries said, please keep this going. We are coming up with difficult issues which we need time, more time to work on and communicate with our policymakers. So we kept it going as a network. And you can see the objective there to keep the idea of tackling chronic poverty on the agenda, on the policy agenda. Just to say a little bit more about what we do, we produce chronic poverty reports. I have left the summary of the last chronic poverty report, which was focused on getting to zero extreme poverty. There are some copies of the summary outside. We are also, in future, we're intending to produce chronic poverty reports focused on growth, on social inclusion and anti-discrimination measures. So this work will contribute to that. And something later on climate change and responses to climate change, all focused on, you know, whether the poorest people are getting a look in these areas of policy and what sort of results can be achieved and how. We've also developed a policy database covering 31, well, the ambition is to cover 31. We've now covered 26 countries, which account for 90% of the extreme poverty in the world. And we're trying to say what were their policies in 2015, including anti-discrimination policies, and how are they changing? And we're going to monitor those over the next few years in the context of the commitments made under the Sustainable Development Goals that Julia was mentioning just now. We also try to develop, in some of these countries at least, chronic poverty coalitions or advocacy groups, which are across the state, a little bit like the group here, I guess. Maybe there are some civil servants here. Sometimes you probably get ministers attending, but there are also civil society organizations and researchers, and we try to bring these groups together at national level in developing countries to work on these issues. In the last chronic poverty report, we said that if you want to eradicate extreme poverty, you need to do three things. Tackle chronic poverty, stop impoverishment, so stop people falling into poverty, because that's quite big in many situations. And then also, it's not enough to just get people over the poverty line, but you need to sustain people's escapes from poverty. So they need to be on an upward trajectory, and that's the way to go. And we identified in that report the kind of policy areas that were important to address these three objectives. Coming to the specific project on evaluating anti-discrimination measures, we're going to talk about phase one. Rachel is going to talk about phase one of the report. This is a rigorous review of evidence of anti-discrimination measures in political participation, education, and labor markets in low and middle-income countries. The focus here is on large-scale actions, so we haven't looked at the very many actions, smaller-scale actions, that NGOs, for example, typically get involved in. And Rachel will talk more about the study base for the report. We've produced two reports now. This is the second report. The first one focuses, if you like, on those three issues, and the second one now focuses on the ways that anti-discrimination measures in these three areas have affected particular marginalized groups. This has been supported by an evaluation partnership, so the expert group has been part of a wider group of donors and also experts that have been supporting the evaluation, and you can see the groups at the bottom of the page, bottom of the slide. So we're planning now a second phase because we found, as Rachel will explain, many gaps in evidence. We don't know what we would like to know about the effects of anti-discrimination measures, although we know something now. So we're planning a number of country studies to try and fill some of these gaps, especially focusing on labor markets and related human development services, which could, of course, include education, as well as health and social protection. So what about the issue of low-income countries? How do these processes work out in low-income countries? We've got limited evidence from a few countries. We want to try and spread the evidence base. And we want eventually to be able to disseminate the results to countries which are thinking about the need for anti-discrimination measures. And we want to expand the evaluation partnership around this work. And I'm going to leave the rest of it to Rachel.
Hello, everybody. So the diagram you see up there tries to capture the issues that we've looked at in this study and also some of the analysis of what leads to success and what doesn't. We picked out four different kinds of approaches to reducing discrimination: legal change, attitude change campaigns, quotas and reservations, which was the area we certainly found most evidence about, and targeted services and financial support for particular groups to access those services generally. And so we looked at the evidence for all of those. A lot of the, unlike other reviews that I've read where there have been a very clear set of evaluations of this works, this doesn't, a lot of the discussion was much, much more contextual, and it talked around the politics of implementation or non-implementation, and there wasn't therefore a lot of analysis of the context and what leads to success. So it emerged that there being high-level political support, having an engaged civil society, sufficient resourcing of programs, and a supportive institutional context for implementation were really important. And where those were in place, you know, that we found evidence of success, less discriminatory attitudes, reduced experiences of discrimination. But these measures are really controversial, and we also found a lot of evidence of resistance and backlash, or simply of non-implementation. And there's a question which we'll discuss a little further on about how far are they captured by elites and how far do they really benefit poorer people. So moving on to the evidence base that we found about particular marginalized groups, as you can see, the single group for which there is the most are women and children and young people. It's important to say, though, that the material on children and young people was almost entirely focused on education. So we only found a few studies that looked at whether anti-discrimination measures in labour markets, for example, benefited the well-being of children in those families. We did find a few studies that showed that political reservations led to improved services, which then benefited children in those localities. The diagram shows quite a large number of studies on people with disabilities, but they were very skewed. They tended to be laying out that certain legislation existed, but and then how poor the situation was, but not really tracing through how that had led to policies or programs and why implementation had failed. Also, on the evidence base, as you can see, the majority of the studies came from middle-income countries, with the exception of East Africa, though it must also be said that India's policies go back a long time, and you know it was a low-income country when a lot of those policies were started up and during the lifetime of many of those policies, even if it's now classified as middle-income. So then the key findings from the report. Overall, we found that affirmative action measures definitely can increase the representation of people from designated groups. That much is very clear. And there are many instances where it has also improved well-being. So, for example, you know, we found that it's led to increased representation in higher education in various countries and improved access to the labour market in some countries. There have been quite a lot of examples where experience hasn't been so positive, which I'll come on to later, but the big picture is that, you know, there are definitely circumstances where these have been effective and positive measures, and we shouldn't lose sight of that. There has been a clear neglect of people with disabilities. And then we come on to questions about some of the detail, because the big picture is positive, but there are a lot of buts. And one is that the labels of being a marginalized group, whether that's a marginalized caste or a certain ethnic group, or women, and therefore that leading to access to resources, is very politically controversial. And because it's politically controversial, there are lots of arguments around the boundaries. You know, is that group disadvantaged or not? Is this group equally deserving? And so on. Also, there are issues to do with the fact that people have many different identities, and labelling one group as deserving of additional attention and resources may mean that other aspects of those are marginalised and forgotten, and it may not be the most important thing in people's lives. So moving through the three sectors that we looked at, political representation. And we did find clear evidence, really, across almost all the countries that political reservations have increased the representation of marginalised groups, both at local level, in local councils, in parliaments, and in political parties. But how far has that led to actual improvements for those groups? There's mixed evidence on that. There's some studies have shown that, for example, from India, that women's reservations and reservations for scheduled castes and tribes, the marginalised castes and tribes, have led to better social service in those areas. And there's some new research showing that they've led to better nutritional outcomes in those areas. But qualitative evidence is more mixed. And, for example, taking the example of women in reserved seats in India, some of it shows that women have not been always able to advocate for the issues they wish to, and that have been at the mercy of the agendas of powerful men locally. There's also some evidence, particularly from South Africa, of women being pushed into or self-selecting into certain agendas, usually to do with social services, sometimes to do with access to water, all important issues. And that's not to say that these are not things that anybody should work on, but that certainly women have been marginalized from working on issues that have traditionally been seen as harder issues to do with finance and defense quite often. There's also the issue that where people have come to power through a quota, they're sometimes driven more loyalty to the political party or to a patron in that political party than to the group that they're representing. And it's further complicated by political ideologies, which people may be more concerned about, more of a motivation than trying to improve their specific group. And then also, you know, a woman representative is also of a certain ethnic group or a region, and those regional interests or those ethnic interests or religious interests may be more important than gender, for example. So moving to education, the second area that we looked at. Overall, we found positive evidence from all areas of education, primary through to higher education, that affirmative action policies have been successful in increasing the participation of targeted groups and learning among those groups. We found no evidence at all about the preschool level, which is why that's not mentioned here. But these gains haven't always been matched with a more positive experience in schools. So, for example, again, qualitative evidence from India and quantitative too shows that mistreatment of low-caste children is a major reason for them to drop out. So although there are, on the one hand, anti-discrimination laws and stipends and targeted programs to try to increase their representation, when they're actually there, if they're still being treated in discriminatory ways, it only counts for so much. One other issue is that a lot of the targeted measures have been at the higher education level. But the people who are reaching higher education from disabled people or in low-income countries, women, for example, are not the poorest at all. And so in that way, those measures are reaching the better off groups rather than poorer groups. And for that reason, we recommend that reducing inequalities much lower down the education system at primary and secondary school is more likely to be effective in the longer run. Also, the most appropriate measures vary according to context and group, which makes it difficult to draw very kind of wide-ranging conclusions. For example, for disabled children, a mix of measures to do with changed attitudes, with specific support for children with particular kinds of disability are important, whereas, for children from ethnic minorities who don't speak the national language, then bilingual schooling must be maybe more important, and where there's a clear relationship between poverty and discrimination, as there often is, it may be that financial support and more inclusive services is the most effective way to approach that non-participation or high levels of dropout of children from particular groups. Moving on to labour markets, we have found some clear positive successes from India in particular of labour market reservations that have enabled lower caste people to access lower levels of government jobs. These reservations are only available in government jobs and they are concentrated at the lower levels, so there are concerns about how far they really lead these groups out of poverty, or do they trap them just above the poverty line. There are arguments both ways, but even if they don't lead these groups out of poverty, they at least protect them from being in poverty, and there's evidence that if they were removed, they would fall back into poverty. From South Africa, again, there's mixed evidence. On the one hand, affirmative action measures in the labour market have contributed to the development of a black middle-class elite. On the other hand, there are questions about how far it's contributed to addressing poverty in the wider set of the population. In other parts of the world, the focus of measures in the labour market has been less quotas or reservations and more around targeted programmes for particular groups. So in Latin America, in particular, there have been a lot of targeted programmes for marginalised youth to try to increase their skill base so they can better participate in the labour market. Those have typically focused on young women, on young people from poor areas, and have been relatively effective in improving their skill levels and their subsequent employment levels. That's been highly dependent on there being good quality, well-funded programmes, though, and the broader economic context, which has generally been positive. One surprise we found was very little on the role of trade unions in combating discrimination. We expected to find more. What we did find was evidence of unions mobilising around particularly exploited groups, like women domestic workers, for example, but not using the discrimination lens to try to advance the situation of discriminated groups. So where laws exist for that, a certain proportion of any big employer should be, say, disabled people or members of a certain ethnic group, unions were not, on the whole, getting involved in trying to make that more effective or fighting cases on the basis of discrimination. So given the focus on poverty then, how effective have these measures been in reducing poverty? Well, as I mentioned earlier, that there is a clear positive impact on enabling people to move into higher education and to better access the labour market. What hasn't been clearly established is what the long-term effects of that have been. Policies tend to be evaluated, after 5 at most, sometimes 10 years of evidence, with the exception of India, where evidence is longer standing. And so we don't really know if that has sustainably helped people escape from poverty or not. Does it primarily benefit the better off? Well, as I mentioned earlier, reservations in higher education have tended to where they've been focused on women and disabled people. But there are counterexamples from Brazil, for example, where race-based reservations actually have benefited the poorer groups, disproportionately Afro-Brazilians who are from a poorer group have been able to take up places in higher education that they wouldn't otherwise have done. Also, India, where this issue is very, very controversial, the quantitative evidence suggests that because job reservations are not available to people from families earning over a certain amount, and because they're concentrated in the lower areas of government service, that they do, in fact, have a pro-poor effect, and likewise with the education reservations. So to run through some of the effects on particular groups, this slide summarises the evidence we found in terms of where there is most evidence and where there's less evidence. I'm thinking, though, that the women's reservations, the women bullet really should be in green because there's a lot of evidence around political reservations, less so for higher education. And I will move through 2 of the groups that we have focused on in order to give enough time to focus on conclusions and recommendations as well. So around women and girls, as I mentioned, there's been a big focus on political representation, to a lesser extent higher education and school education for girls, with many campaigns to enhance girls' school attendance, to encourage families to send them, and in many countries targeted stipends to advance our participation as well. There's certainly been success in increasing numbers. There's been less success in challenging discriminatory attitudes and practices. And I think importantly, there's been less attention to gendered patterns of inequality affecting men and boys, and particularly the pressures on boys to drop out of school. And issues where affirmative action has somewhat backfired in that it's created resentment for targeted stipends for girls and actually led to lower levels of participation among boys. Sorry, I missed one. With respect to marginalised ethnic and racial groups, there's less evidence on political representation, but some concerns that if there are quotas based on ethnicity or race, for example, it becomes a more socially significant issue rather than less significant, that it could actually increase racism rather than reduce it. The literature we examined doesn't resolve that issue either way, but it does throw it out there as a concern. We found strong positive evidence for bilingual education in early grades or mother tongue education transitioning to education in a national language later. Much less evidence of this around in relation to secondary schooling. Some studies don't find a positive effect, but most commonly they do. We found university reservations generally effective, but often slightly crude, in that most countries are multi-ethnic. The targeted group often does well out of it, but it increases inequalities against other groups that have not been seen as deserving of these protections. One example is Indians in Malaysia, for example, who now have a high concentration of poverty in that group. And then there are also resentments around labour market reservations, which are often seen as unfair. I just will quickly mention some of the issues to do with disability, which we've flagged consistently as neglected and underrepresented. In our study, we only found one example of political reservations for disabled people, which was in local councils in Uganda, with no assessment of how effective they actually were. We found that labour market provisions were rarely enforced, and there's much evidence of discrimination, both in labour markets and in schools. There's a lot of evidence, or there's a lot of writing around inclusive education in schools, most of it focusing on barriers to implementation and challenges, and with relatively little evidence of success. And some impacts in higher education, but we also found, again, this was often undermined by attitudes, so that students were shunted into subjects that administrators considered they could do with their disability without them actually necessarily having the interest to study those issues. And finance being a big issue, in that financial barriers were preventing a lot of disabled students taking up the opportunities that were available. I'm going to skip over the evidence gaps. We can always come back to that later if there's time, and move to the conclusions and recommendations. Firstly, the report was wide-ranging. We looked at a lot of different groups, some of which there were almost no information on, such as refugees, such as LGBTQI groups, and so on. But it's clear from even with the four or five main groups that we looked at, that the issues, on the one hand, they're all affected by discrimination, but it plays out in very different ways. And so so policies and programs need to be carefully tailored to those groups. And they also need review, because policies, when they're effective, they can change the situation of a marginalized group quite quickly. And they need regular review to be sure that they're still, that group still needs that additional support, and that there are not other groups who have been marginalized by this, who perhaps now are facing worse poverty and discrimination, and who should be focused on. These are clearly controversial issues. So on the one hand, there's a lot that's positive and they can be effective, but they also generate a lot of resistance and backlash, which means that donors in particular need to tread carefully in these areas. Our review suggests that because of this, that inclusive economic policies and services should generally be the priority. For example, we found evidence from Mexico that just improving the quality of education and the access to education in ethnic minority areas through an inclusive education program did a lot to improve the education and opportunities of ethnic minority children. But that won't always be enough, and there will be cases where additional targeted support to particular groups is needed, and whether that's for particularly challenging gender discrimination, or whether it's to enable disabled children to attend school or whatever. We found that there was a general lack of joining together anti-poverty and discrimination issues, and so often there wasn't enough attention to the way they worked in parallel, and there needed to be more attention to addressing the economic constraints that affect marginalized groups as well. Finally, returning then to some of the issues we brought up at the beginning on that theory of change slide, it's clear that a stronger institutional framework is really important for these policies to work properly. One reason, for example, that the labour market provisions, where they existed, weren't actually having much impact was that people could not afford to bring a case through the courts, and they had no confidence that if they did bring a case through the courts, that it would actually be seen fairly and would lead to any positive income. We also found that there's a clear role for attitude change activities alongside legislation. And without that, you can have, as the case of India showed, many more low-caste children attending school but facing such discrimination when they were there that they're not able to learn and are dropping out again. And finally, we found a clear role for rights-based social movements, both in putting anti-discrimination issues on the agenda. For example, there's evidence that shows that a lot of pro-gender equality legislation, particularly around domestic violence, has come from the mobilisation of women's movements more than any other issue. And again, around inclusive education of disabled children, that's been very much driven by disabled people's organisations. So both for putting the issues on the agenda, but also for holding governments to account by keeping on highlighting what is or isn't happening in terms of these groups and how their rights are still not being met. So I'll stop there and hand over to Per, I think, who's going to speak now.
I'm just going to give you a quick introduction, and thank you both, Rachel and Andrew, of course.